My guest now is one of the world's foremost theoretical physicists. Professor Brian Greene is head of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics and is the co-founder and chairman of the World Science Festival. He's the author of six best-selling books, including the hugely successful The Elegant Universe and his most recent, Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe, in which he explains the cosmos and our quest to find meaning in the face of this vast expanse. Professor Greene says to understand the history of our universe and its future, we must understand that humans have only existed in it for a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of its history. And in doing so, we gain an understanding of how unique, fragile and meaningful our circumstances are. Professor Greene, welcome to 9 to Noon and thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
I had this picture in my head of you being so excited, as so many were a few weeks ago when we got our first look at the supermassive black hole at the centre of our galaxy. What was that like for you, that moment?
Yeah, well, it was an amazing moment, absolutely. As a physicist, I have been studying the mathematics behind black holes since I was a graduate student way back in the 1980s. And when we finally get to see these things, literally through photographs taken by radio telescopes, the Event Horizon Telescope, it's just so thrilling to see the mathematics writ large across the night sky, where you actually see the edge of a black hole. You see the properties of black holes aligning so spectacularly well with the mathematics that ultimately came to us from Albert Einstein. So yes, your image of my excitement is right on point.
Look, a lot of people, including colleagues of mine here at RNZ, I've had some fascinating discussions about this today, are really overwhelmed actually by just thinking about the vastness and the unknown of the universe. But you're arguing here that it's vital that we try and get our heads around it. Why?
Well, I think if you really want to understand humankind's place in the cosmic order, you have to understand that cosmic order, or at least you have to take strides toward understanding it. Because when you recognize that we are not distinct from the universe, right? We are made from the very same material ingredients. We are governed by the very same mathematical laws that govern black holes, that govern planets, that govern stars. You recognize that there's a beautiful continuum between the fundamental laws, the fundamental ingredients, and structures that we identify as ourselves, and thinking structures that we identified as gloppy gray brains inside of our heads that we usually identify with who we are as individuals. So to recognize that we are nothing but highly organized collections of the very ingredients that make up everything else in the universe, that shows a deep connection and also suggests strongly that to understand ourselves, we need to understand the basic structure of the cosmos.
When I was thinking about this, because I'm not overwhelmed by it, I find it exciting, but I love sci-fi. I'm a Trekkie. I've watched pretty much every iteration of that. So I enjoy, in fact, I think I take comfort in hoping, if not believing, that the universe must contain other forms of life or sentient life, whatever you think about. I think I would be more distraught to think that we're it. Everything's on our shoulders. What's your view on this?
Well, yeah, I kind of go both ways on that. In the end of the day, I recognize that my predilection for or against extraterrestrial life has no impact on whether there actually is extraterrestrial life. And I think I take comfort in that thought. But it's certainly the case that if life is nothing but matter that's organized into a highly structured configuration, if that structure is not so dissimilar from the kinds of structures that can form elsewhere in the world, and that seems to be the case, right? It seems to be that it didn't take life long to form on planet Earth, right? Half a billion years after the formation of Earth, the beginnings of life started to bubble up. So it doesn't seem like it's that hard. And that would suggest that it has happened elsewhere in the cosmos, as we now know that there are many planets orbiting many stars. And so the possibilities seem enormous for that to have taken place. The more subtle question is, what about intelligent life? on that, I don't think we have any information at all. We don't really know what it takes for matter not just to organize itself into a living structure, but to organize itself into a living structure that can think and can feel and can have a sense of self and a curiosity about the universe. That kind of organized matter, I don't know how likely or unlikely that may be. So maybe there's a lot of life out there, still a question mark, but even if there is, how much intelligent life is out there in the sense of being able to communicate with us? That to me is the larger unknown, and I don't have any insight, and I don't think anybody else does either.
We can, though, I think, talk about the story of our universe. And, I mean, is there universal agreement, and it was a deliberate pun, on how old it is? What's our latest understanding?
Of how old the universe is?
Yeah.
Well, if you focus on the universe that we have direct access to, because there might be others, but let's just keep the conversation simple. If you focus on this universe, it appears to have begun about 13.8 billion years ago in this rapid swelling of space that we call the Big Bang. But the natural next question is, okay, so what was before the Big Bang? What started the Big Bang? How did the material that ultimately gave rise to the expansion of space itself, how did it come to be? There's so many unknowns about the origin story of the cosmos that the best we can say is something really interesting happened 13.8 billion years ago, and that seems to be directly connected with the expansion of space that we currently observe and the formation of structures like stars and galaxies that we can see dotting the night sky. But if you ask me truly how did it begin, that's a question we can't really answer because it goes beyond what our mathematical theories give us insight into.
I thought it was very useful. You gave also an example of if the universe was, or the value was squished into one day, humans would show up when?
Yeah, if it's one day, oh God, it's even worse. I'd like to think of it, if you take the history of the universe and you crush it into 1 year, so there's going to be a factor of about 365 relevant to your question. But on that scale, we humans appear at like 11:50 p.m., you know, a handful of minutes before midnight on December 31st of the calendar year. Imagine that. The whole history of the universe squashed into a single calendar year, and we don't show up until the last handful of minutes. That's how small our footprint is on the cosmic timeline.
So what are some of the other, I like the word mystery, actually, rather than questions. And I'm a big fan of mysteries. I'm not sure if I want us to have all the facts and figures. I'm not sure if I want to be able to talk to you in 10, 20, 30 years. And so,
why?
Yes, definitively, we know this.
Why?
No, I believe in mystery. I think not knowing some things is empowering.
I do too. So I do too. I love mystery. I love questions. But I recognize that as we learn more, my ability to ask the questions grows deeper and my appreciation for the answers becomes ever more expansive. So I don't want to be in a place of ignorance. I don't want to be in a place of not knowing if there is an answer that we can find, because that doesn't eliminate the wonder of the cosmos. For me, at least, it simply deepens it. And the questions are unending, so we'll never be faced with a situation of knowing it all. So why don't we try to know as much as we possibly can?
That's given me food for thought. I thank you for it. Our concept of time, how is that evolving?
Well, it's interesting. If you go back to the late 1800s, the concept of time that just about everybody had is the intuitive one, right? I mean, time elapses second after second after second, and it seems to be that a second for you is the same as a second for me, and the way in which time elapses is completely independent, we would think, of our emotion or the environment that we are within. That's common human experience, and that's what everybody thought up until the end of the 1800s. In the beginning of the 1900s, Albert Einstein comes along with his theories of relativity and shows that that way of thinking about time is an artifact of the very special conditions that we humans experience. if we travel really quickly, or if we experience really strong gravitational fields, Einstein showed mathematically, and subsequent experiments have demonstrated, time has very different qualities. If I go really quickly out into space and you watch me, you will think and see and perceive that my clock ticks off at a rate that is slower than yours. In fact, if I go all the way out, say, for 6 months near the speed of light, and then I turn around and I come back, my clock will be ticking so slowly compared to yours that when I step off the ship, I will be 1 year older, 6 months out, 6 months back from my experience, but you will be 10 years older or 1,000 years older, even 1,000,000 years older, all depending on how quickly I traveled. So time is much more flexible than we would have thought based on common experience. And I think that's a deeply enriching feature of the temporal quality of the universe that nobody anticipated prior to Einstein's discoveries of relativity.
Could you explain to me the concept, and this is well traversed in science fiction and in theses also, this concept of parallel universes, and should they exist, how they operate?
Yeah, so I'm happy to do it. The one remark I'll make before that, though, is to say that when it comes to weird things like time elapsing at different rates, that is experimentally verified. When it comes to ideas like black holes, as you started our conversation with, that is experimentally verified through powerful observations that have seen these black holes. When it comes to ideas of parallel universes, I need to emphasize that this is a highly speculative idea. We do not know whether it's correct, but our mathematical theories do suggest that there may be other realms separate from our universe that should rightly be called universes of their own. And those other universes could have different properties. They could be inhabited by life forms. They could be full of particles that are following different laws relative to the laws that we are familiar with. And one way to think about it is, you asked about the age of our universe, and I spoke about 13.8 billion years. That's when we believe the Big Bang took place. Some of our mathematical theories strongly suggest that the Big Bang was not a one-time event. There are many Big Bangs. One of those Big Bangs gave rise to our realm that we inhabit, but the mathematics suggests that these other Big Bangs happening at far-flung locations throughout the wider expanse of reality, those different Big Bangs would give rise to different universes. And so it would be kind of like a giant cosmic bubble bath, if you will, where our bubble is our universe, but there are other bubbles in the cosmic bubble bath, which would be other universes populating this landscape of reality.
I think cosmic bubble bath is one of my favorite concepts, and it actually really helps me to get my head around it. I mean, for many of the big questions that we get to, or mysteries that we were talking about, how are we likely to answer them? Is it the advance of computing power? We know how important that was, say, with the black hole. Is it shooting telescopes and probes into space? What's our next step?
It depends on what the question is, but the quick answer is all of these approaches help advance knowledge and understanding. I mean, I come from the more mathematical end of scientific research. So the work that I do and my colleagues and my students tends to be calculations on paper. Sometimes we do, in fact, use computers to advance our understanding of those calculations. And all of that is vital to our deepening appreciation of these grand mysteries of reality. But yes, we absolutely need to have powerful telescopes that can look deeply into space, which is effectively looking deeply back in time to gain observational insight into the nature of reality. And powerful computer simulations certainly are another tool that we are using to gain more and more insight. So it's really a combination of computational power, observation, experimentation. The Large Hadron Collider is a place where we've learned a lot about the structure of matter, together with mathematical analysis that tries to place it all, put it all together into a coherent and testable format.
I'm talking to Professor Brian Green, head of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics and author and science communicator. Humans, as we talked about earlier, have only been here a minuscule amount of time, but we've survived an ice age, we had the Black Plague, we had world wars, flown to the moon and beyond, improved our lifespans and living conditions. We've got the internet, so we've got access to all this information about our past failures. But it feels like humans haven't learned from history and therefore are doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. Shouldn't we have learned better or learned more given what we've gone through?
Well, I mean, that's, of course, the tragedy of the human condition. We have been through and we have surmounted a great many challenges if you look through the history of the species. And when you analyze and look at what's happening today, you can't help but say, how could it be? How could it be that we're still fighting and killing each other? How can it be that we are still so selfish that we're unable to see that there are things that we need to do for everybody in order that all of us can survive and flourish and reach human potential? So yes, it is tragic, but at the same time, I have to say I am an optimist. I do think that overall, we will be able to surmount the challenges that we face. It will be painful. There will be catastrophes. There will be tragedies. Unfortunately, we see them unfolding, at least here in America, now almost on a daily basis. So it's utterly astounding what we do to ourselves. But I like to think that these are momentary blips, momentary challenges, momentary setbacks in the grand scheme of human progress, because there is so much on the positive side. Look at what we've done. We were able to manipulate matter. We've been able to travel to the moon. We're able to look into deep space. We've been able to unravel the fundamental laws that govern particles. I mean, this is an amazing achievement. And collectively, I can't help but think that we will be able to surmount the challenges that we face. But yes, I agree with you. It's it is really tragic that we still face the hurdles that we set for ourselves because they're so unnecessary.
Well, you're a glass half full. I'm a glass half empty kind of person. So if we're looking ahead to how long humanity is going to last, I mean, we know that the sun has a finite lifespan. So somewhere along the line, the Earth is not going to be here sometime in the future. But what about humanity, Brian? I mean, what is our future? What is our lifespan looking like, do you think?
Obviously, it's hard to say when you're talking about the lifespan of the sun. Yeah, we've got another 5 billion years. So I wouldn't place that as one of the main worries that we currently face. But I do feel that, you know, if we can recognize the power of human ingenuity, we should be able to overcome the challenges of climate change. We should be able to overcome the challenges of the fact that members of our species kill other members of our species. I can't help but think that these are issues that we won't be able to overcome. So then what is the future of the species? Well, I do think that there's going to be a powerful blending of the biological organic form of human beings together with a technological version. There's going to be a blending of the artificial and the organic. And so it could well be that 100 or 1,000 years from now, you won't recognize our species in the particular form of life that may be wandering around this planet, but you'll be able to trace it back to us. I don't think that we're going to go extinct. I do think that we are going to evolve and evolve in a manner that may be unrecognizable.
Will the universe come to an end?
Well, it depends what you mean by end. Space and time, I suspect, will always be here. But organized structures like planets and stars, they may not be. In fact, everything that we know suggests that planets and stars and other agglomerations of matter ultimately will dissipate, will fall apart. They will disintegrate. The timescales you can actually calculate, it's roughly on the order of, say, 10 to 100 years from now. We're now only about 10 to the 10 years since the Big Bang, and 10 to the 100 is well larger than 10 to the 10. But yes, if you use our current understanding, it does suggest that organized matter ultimately will disintegrate into particles that will just waft through the darkness for nearly an eternity from that point forward.
We're getting some very deep questions from our listeners for you. So this one says, ask about the time scale of the death of the last star in comparison to the last black hole or end of the universe. I'm not sure I understand. Do you get that one?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted, but I understand the question well. So the questioner is asking, when will there no longer be any stars dotting the night sky? And that's probably on the order of 10 to the 14 years from now. So still far, but not that far. Black holes themselves are likely to last until about 10 to the 100 years from now. That's where I got that number from when I was talking about the end of organized structure. So yes, stars will use up their nuclear fuel. They will fade to black and ultimately will dissipate into particles that themselves can be captured by black holes. But black holes are not forever either. Stephen Hawking taught us in the 1970s that black holes also slowly dissipate. They slowly disintegrate. They do it on much longer timescales, and that's where the number of 10 to the 100 comes from. So those are the two timescales. For the death of stars, 10 to the 14. Death of black holes, if they're really large, 10 to the 100.
Just two words from this text, O'Brien: dark matter.
Well, yeah. Dark matter is, again, one of those grand mysteries we recognized all the way back in the 1930s through work of people like Fritz Zwicky and Vera Rubin, that there is more matter in space than we can see because a lot of the matter does not give off light. And if the matter doesn't give off light, you can't see it. It's dark matter. And so the mystery has been, we know it's there because we can feel its gravitational pull, but we've been unable to identify what actually makes up the dark matter. Is it made of the same stuff that makes up you and me? Protons, neutrons, electrons? It seems that's not the case. And if it's not the case, then what are the particles? What are the ingredients that make up the dark stuff? And so this is a mystery. Whoever solves it will have a nice trip to Stockholm. And it may happen in the near future. We don't know. There are many experiments that are trying to capture exotic particles that have been proposed by various mathematical theories for what the dark matter may be. So far, there's no convincing evidence that we have captured a dark matter particle, but it could happen in the not too distant future.
If you could have a wish granted of all the questions and mysteries we talked about before yet to be answered that you're confident can be answered, which would you most like to be answered in your lifetime, in your time, on our minuscule amount of time in the universe?
Well, yeah, it's a tough question. And the caveat there that I'm confident that we can answer, that's the tough one. So I'm going to actually take out that caveat and say what question which I'd like to have answered. And that simply is, why is there something rather than nothing, right? That's the deepest question. Leibniz phrased it that way a long time ago. And I think that's the deep one, right? Why is there anything at all? I don't mean, you know, why is there stuff in space? Why is there space? Why is there time? Why is there mathematics? Why is there anything at all as opposed to the deepest definition of nothingness? I don't know what the answer to that is, but wow, if we could gain some insight into that, that would be a radical eye-opening experience to have some understanding of why there is something rather than nothing.
We're going to have to bring you back, Brian, because the our texts are about to explode with questions for you. But here's one I find delightful. If you're driving through the universe at the speed of light and turned your headlights on, would it make any difference?
Well, first off, you can't drive through the universe at the speed of light. So I have to change the question a little bit. You can go really close to the speed of light. And that actually is a critical part of the answer. Because if you're going really near the speed of light and you turn on your headlights, from your perspective, the light will stream away from you as it always would at exactly the same speed, whatever units you like, 186,000 miles per second, 300 million meters, you know, per second as well, whatever units you like. But the point is, speed of light is constant. So from your perspective, it's going to race away at the speed of light. And from any observer watching you, it's going to race away at that exact same speed. That's the weirdness of the speed of light. And it will hold true regardless of how fast you're moving, even if you are just an iota less than the speed of light itself.
Just to wrap this up, Brian, as I say, we've got so many more questions for you, but I love this, your pleasure of standing and looking up at the night sky. I mean, we're very blessed in parts of New Zealand. In fact, we have dark sky covenants in some parts of the country, which I really recommend people go to if they can. But for you, when you look up at the night sky, what do you feel, understanding the universe in the way that you do?
Well, it depends on where I am, because I currently, you know, I'm in my apartment in New York City, and a deep, dark night sky reveals about 3 stars. So it's not exactly an overwhelming experience in New York City, but we also have a place upstate in the Catskill Mountains. And there, it sounds like it's similar to your view of the night sky. You see the deep richness of the heavens and all the resplendent glory, chock full glory of all the wonderful points of light out there. And you can't help but feel the very thing that we started our conversation with. You feel a connection to that cosmos. You feel like you are immersed within it. You are part of it. And that's a real feeling, because that actually is the human condition. We are not separate from the cosmos. We are part of it.
I appreciate the conversation. I've learned so much. Thank you, Brian. Brian Green, Professor of Physics and Mathematics, Director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics, and also the author of many books, the last one which we've been referencing here, Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. And thank you so much for all your feedback. It's been fascinating.